Hi, everyone. Good afternoon. My name is Tony Rossford. I'm a trial lawyer in Cleveland, Ohio at Thompson Hine. And I thanks everyone for joining me today to talk about mediation advocacy, an area I'm pretty passionate about. I enjoy figuring out how the best way to articulate my client's positions in a mediation to achieve a favorable resolution. But first, I'm a trial lawyer, and as we all know, there are not nearly as many trials as there used to be, and that there are many that have coined the term the vanishing trial. In preparing for this webinar, I came across a recent Law 360 article that I said, well, I've got to lead with this because this really sets out the view of trials and their impact on and how mediation impacts trials. But a recent Law 360 article applauded the disappearance of jury trials because, quote, lawyers who try cases to juries are con men and charlatans, and jurors are gullible. The article goes on to say the skill of trying cases to a jury is dying for good reasons of law, procedure, and market alternatives. No doubt this is a disappointment to a certain class of trial lawyers who feel that they could convince anyone of anything, but that skill is of no value. So let's talk about the vanishing trial and just give you a little bit of data on the number of trials that are cases that are disposed by trials. Again, as I mentioned, the vanishing trial was coined by Patricia Lee Renfro in an ABA study in 2004, where she found that only 1.8% of all federal cases were disposed of by trial in 2002. This trend has continued, and as recently as 2015, it's been reported that less than 1% of cases actually go to trial. I was able to find some state data from the New York Office of Court Administration that say that only in 2017, only 10% of cases went to trial, so a little higher at the state court level, but there is a significant reduction in the amount of trials over the last 50 years. So what are the reasons? We could probably do a whole webinar on why there is a decline in the number of trials, but one of the reasons cited by many commentators are that it's becoming too expensive to try cases. The soaring discovery costs, including e-discovery costs, have made it cost prohibitive to take your case to a point where there's a decision by a judge or a jury through a trial. It also takes too much time, some commentators and people argue, because you used to be able to file a case and get it tried relatively in a short amount of period of time, less than 1 year. Now there are some cases that in complex cases that go well over a year, some into 2 and 3 years. And then the final one, which will kind of lead to the rest of our discussion today, is the proliferation of mediation. Many more cases are being disposed of prior to a trial because mediation has become popular. And the reason I think that's becoming more popular is parties and clients, particularly business clients, are seeking quicker, less expensive ways to resolve their dispute. So, is this the new normal? If mediation is, most of our cases are going to be decided prior to trial, and the most popular way to do that is through mediation, what does that mean for trial lawyers and trial skills? Some legal commentators have contended that the skills to be an effective mediation advocate are incompatible with the trial skills that we have as trial lawyers. They say the advocacy skills in mediation are different from those used in trial advocacy. So as the Law 360 article stated, these commentators would say, and the author of the Law 360 article, that these skills are of no value. But I disagree. I think many of the skills and characteristics that make us effective trial lawyers also make us effective advocates in mediation. I would go even further to say that in-house counsel would be well served using trial lawyers in mediation because of these skills of being a good trial lawyer do translate to the mediation forum, and I'll just talk about some of those skills that I think are important or characteristics. For those following along, we're on slide 7 of the materials. And the first is the ability to think on their feet. Good trial lawyers present well when they are being spontaneous, despite surprises or curveballs presented to them at trial. This happens in mediation, too, through the shuttle diplomacy. A mediator may come in with a document or an argument, and you have to be quick on your feet to respond to those, to the mediator and the positions of the other party. Top trial lawyers are also detail-oriented. They worry about the details of a case, and they realize that making a mistake or looking foolish can be a powerful performance enhancer. We also, good trial lawyers, mine the details, which allows us to plan ahead, think ahead, and anticipate issues. Again, all that skill translates well into the mediation context. Trial lawyers also have good judgment. We keep our cool under pressure. In every phase of a jury trial, we know when to stay silent. We know not to take ridiculous positions in discovery. We do not potentially embarrass witnesses on direct or on cross-examination. We have the confidence to know when we've made our point in trial, and I think that same judgment applies in the mediation context. Great trial lawyers also have a high credibility. Our credibility is so vital to our success that is often described as our most important asset. We are vigilant and protect our credibility, and this credibility allows us to effectively represent our clients at trial. I believe this credibility also is important in the mediation context in persuading the decision maker, the other party, in having the mediator trust and work for you in that other room. Trial lawyers are also creative. We look outside the box for solutions to bring a trial to a successful close. And sometimes the answers to getting a resolution or trying a case are not right in front of you. We have to be creative and an investigative lawyer to develop these alternative approaches. And we don't cling to viewpoints that are not going to lead to success. Very important in the mediation context to be creative. It may not be as simple as a payment by party A to party B. Creative solutions are built for the mediation process. Trial lawyers are also tenacious. They need to be prepared to go great lengths to see your case to the finish line. And this requires hard work and continue to press forward. As you'll hear me discuss later on, I think having tenacity is critically important to the mediation process, that you're willing to go to the bitter end to make sure all avenues are exhausted. And you also want your mediator to have that tenacity as well. Another skill that translates from the courtroom to the mediation conference room is being reasonable. A good trial lawyer must have the skill to figure out which conclusion is more suitable to an issue and can suggest reasonable solutions to problems that arise at trial. The rest, including litigators, often create them or complain about solutions. In contrast, reasonable lawyers are quick to suggest workable solutions no matter how difficult the problem. I think this is the perfect attitude for mediation. Finally, good trial lawyers are prepared. And I will spend the rest of our 50 minutes together talking about how important preparation is to the success of a mediation. And because trial lawyers are so detail-oriented, tenacious, and creative, we spend a lot of time preparing for trial. But I think that same level of participation should equally apply to the mediation context. So for the rest of our time together, we will talk about strategies, best practices that I have used and others have used to effectively prepare for mediation. So why is this big picture before we move on to that? Let's talk about why this is important. Again, I feel that trial skills are not incompatible with mediation advocacy skills. I think they're one and the same. I will caveat that I think lawyers, particularly trial lawyers, need to refine their trial skills for the mediation context. And I think that involves having the right touch and approach to mediation as opposed to trial. So preparation is key, and we'll talk and go into detail about this, but the parties and legal counsel, in my experience, is that we have to be prepared for our cases. We have to prepare for our mediation as if we were preparing for trial. A study conducted by the ABA section of dispute resolution on improving mediation quality found that pre-mediation preparation is critical to a mediation success. Yet all too often, counsel and disputing parties show up to mediation without sufficiently evaluating their case or discussing their goals. Inadequate preparation, like inadequate preparation for a trial, does a disservice to your client. Being prepared and going with the flow once you get into mediation leads to success. So let's talk about a roadmap in our discussion. I want to first talk about the pre-mediation assessment process. I then want to move on to selecting the right mediator. I want to talk about pre-mediation settlement structures. And then we'll spend a little time talking about using experts at mediation, which I think is an underutilized strategy for an effective mediation. And then we'll end with one of my favorite subjects. Do you or don't you give an opening statement at mediation? And if you do, how do you structure it? So let's first talk about the pre-mediation assessment. And I'm on page 12 of the PowerPoint materials. A pre-mediation assessment allows you to identify your client's goals for the mediation and formulate a plan to achieve them. This is your playbook for the mediation process. When effectively executed, a pre-mediation assessment enhances the efficiency and transparency of the mediation process. It can also lead to cost effectiveness and a business-driven solution not otherwise available in litigation. And that goes to the creativity point we discussed earlier. So let's talk about the first step in the pre-mediation assessment, and that is identifying the client's goals. Developing an understanding of the client's objectives allows you to structure a plan to meet those goals during the mediation process. When identifying and assessing goals, counsel should focus on the client's needs and interests and how that may impact the settlement negotiations. Having this conversation on the front end and understanding where you're heading or where your client wants to head allows you to frame the rest of the assessment. Counsel's role, whether that be in-house counsel or outside counsel, is to explore and uncover the client's true needs and interests. They can accomplish this by asking a series of questions about the genesis of the dispute. What led to the mediation? What led to the problems between the two parties? What are the client's goals in light of those issues? And what are the reasons behind those goals? Once counsel has identified the client's needs and interests, these goals need to be prioritized with the client. And that allows you to then start developing settlement positions. During the mediation process, you may need to re-examine those goals, depending on how the day plays out or the days play out and what you learn about the other side's position. But the role of the lawyer in that pre-mediation assessment is identifying which goals need to be satisfied and formulating a plan or playbook that aligns with those goals. Before getting too far along in the pre-mediation assessment, I think it's important to understand or assess is probably the better word, whether this case is a candidate for early resolution. And this can come before a case is even filed. But I think it's important to note here that, you know, we saw that such a high percentage of lawsuits settle before trial. So there's no reason why some disputes should not be resolved prior to the parties incurring the flood of cost and uncertainty relating to litigation. So this assessment or this analysis would come either before a case is filed or shortly thereafter. Indeed, many companies that I have worked with have opted to avoid getting sucked into the litigation vortex and are instead engaging in this pre-litigation mediation. I will acknowledge that some cases cannot be resolved on the front end. Some cases, for lack of a better phrase, the parties need to feel a little pain on both sides to bring some rational thought to a resolution. But there are some cases where it is appropriate to explore the ability for a pre-suit settlement. This, I think, has many benefits, including decreasing cost of the litigation in the dispute resolution process, but it also increases predictability, preserves the confidentiality, and avoids the business disruption of, you know, business people within a company from being detracted from their day-to-day jobs with litigation activities. So let's talk about some of these benefits in engaging in an early resolution. One is to save money. As we talked earlier, litigation is expensive mostly due to the discovery process. But pre-mediation can make financial sense where you could utilize those resources to reach an early mediation, resources that would be used on discovery, and prepare for trial to reach a settlement. An early resolution can also save time. Litigation is a slow process that can take many years to reach a final resolution. Meanwhile, parties become entrenched in their position, and the cost of litigation makes settlement more difficult. Pre-litigation mediation can provide participants with a level of predictability and save thousands of hours that would otherwise be devoted by the business people within the company to the prosecution of the lawsuit. Another benefit of an early resolution is you keep control of the issues. You keep control of the dispute. It allows the parties to control the process. It also makes good business sense because it ensures confidentiality and can avoid the reputational risk and potential embarrassment that might occur if these disputes are aired in the public forum, in the public record of a filed case. Finally, the parties can engage in some limited exchange of information to better understand each other's position, but you control that. You're not sending tens of document requests and interrogatories. You are, you know, trying to figure out exactly what is needed to show your positions to the other side. And again, that reduced cost and allows you to keep control. And then we discussed a few times here, but I think it's important to know that it prevents disruption with the day-to-day business activities that would otherwise be spent on collecting documents, sitting down for interviews, attending depositions, etc. Again, it may not be perfect for every case, but in at least assessing this issue on the front end gives you some control over the process and could reduce your skills or reduce your cost. Assessing this up front is a critical component to any pre-mediation assessment. The next step in the pre-mediation assessment process is to assess the evidence in the law. This is almost a no-brainer, but just like at trial, you need to learn to master the facts. You have to be a master of the facts when it comes to mediation. It's also important to fill in any factual gaps prior to the mediation and figure out the who, the what, the when, and the why. A full understanding of those relevant facts and applicable law is necessary for the client to make an informed decision, but it also can show the mediator that of in the other side that you are prepared, you are ready to go here. While we're willing to resolve this case at this mediation, we have a comprehensive grasp of the facts that we can easily apply in the context of litigation and in the context of the trial. To understand the client's version of the facts, you should do and probably should have already done, depending on how far along the litigation is, if there is an underlying litigation, is to conduct your interviews, review the important documents, and identify key witnesses. And then, again, formulate a plan to obtain any missing information. All of this research is important because it allows us at the pre-mediation assessment phase to analyze the strengths and weaknesses of our known facts prior to going into the mediation, which allows us to anticipate what the other side could say to the mediator, what we could be confronted with in the mediation conference room. By coming to the mediation with this comprehensive grasp of the facts and the law, we can stay out in front of the other side and the media and build credibility with the mediator, showing that we have thought through these issues, we are prepared, we are detail-oriented, and it will allow us to not only educate the mediator, but having a grasp of these facts also allows us to educate the other side and point out their weaknesses. And if they do have strengths, downplay those strengths. After marshaling the key evidence in the law, your role is to analyze the case strengths and weaknesses of your own client's position and conduct a thorough, accurate cost-benefit analysis. The best way to do this is to put yourself in the shoes of the opposing party. What are they likely to argue? What flaws will they see in your client's theory? What bad facts or documents will they focus on? A pre-mediation assessment that contemplates both your client's strengths and weaknesses allows you to develop a realistic bargaining zone, and you'll hear me say that phrase a few times for the mediation. It's a fancy way of saying, what's your settlement range? Further, reviewing the case strengths and weaknesses allows you to build, again, credibility with the mediator. In preparing for mediation, it's critical to control your client's expectations. It's tough to take an advocacy position in litigation and then properly counsel your client, in particular when you're leading into a mediation. But one way of controlling that is to understand that, hey, we have an advocacy bias as a trial lawyers, but we also need to take a step back, and this goes to the trial skill of being reasonable, and engage in a realistic assessment of the case from the perspective of a disinterested neutral. Failing to do this instills an optimistic overconfidence in your client, which may make them less likely to compromise. Lastly, I think it's important in discussing and evaluating the strengths and weaknesses of your case to advise the client that the aim of the mediation is not to win the case, but rather to problem solve. Mediation necessarily involves compromise, which requires collaboration between all participants, regardless of the strengths and weaknesses of the case. I couldn't have said it any better than what they said on the last episode of Game of Thrones that I was watching when I was preparing for this, where Tyrion Lannister says to Jon Snow, "No one is happy, so I guess it's a good compromise." I think that crystallizes the mediation process in a lot of ways. The pre-mediation assessment next step is something we often overlook, but it's important in evaluating the strength of your mediation position and preparing for in developing a realistic settlement range, and that is developing a comprehensive budget. A budget is important because it helps clients set expectations on how the case will proceed if settlement is not reached. It also serves an important role as a starting point for developing a settlement range. It allows the client to determine whether continued litigation is cost prohibitive, determine if the client is willing to incur the necessary expenses associated with taking the case to trial. If we don't settle here today, it's going to cost you X to get this through summary judgment and an additional Y to get you through trial. Armed with that realistic budget, you can then compare the cost of taking the case to trial versus the possibility of obtaining a business resolution or resolution at mediation. The next step is consult with experts, and we'll talk about this in a little bit more detail on how to use experts during the mediation process, but I also think experts should be involved in the pre-mediation assessment as well. And one way of doing this is to get them involved in the pre-mediation assessment, particularly in cases involving complex disputes. One of the benefits of having an expert involved in this assessment is that it does help you, having an expert does allow you to get an unbiased opinion and evaluate the strengths and weaknesses of your case. And one of the things I found experts to be particularly helpful is their ability to pinpoint major areas of disputes between the parties and help me develop strengths and weaknesses assessment and to provide additional guidance to the client. The next step is to consider roadblocks in the, that could come up in mediation. This is just another way of saying this is you're playing chess. You're thinking a three or four moves ahead on what could happen, what are the potential deal breakers, and whether there's other moves that we could make to get around them. This allows your client to make an informed decision whether settlement is even reasonable. There are some roadblocks that are truly roadblocks that will prevent settlement. It's better to know those obstacles up front and assess if indeed they are truly are roadblocks. And some of these roadblocks could be, you know, failed earlier settlement negotiations. Your client may not have the resources to fund the settlement. That's obviously a big problem that would prevent a straightforward payment of from party A to party B. There are also many business concerns, reputational and stock price concerns, multiple parties being involved. These are the type of obstacles that should at least be raised and considered in the pre-mediation assessment process. Why is it important to consider these roadblocks? And I'm on page, for those following along at home, on page 24 of the PowerPoint. Analyzing potential settlement hurdles and roadblocks allows you to make, you and your client to make an informed decision as to whether a resolution is feasible. Counsel can use this as an opportunity to reframe potential obstacles and propose settlement alternatives to get around them. Indeed, the beauty of mediation is that it's not a win-lose proposition, but rather an opportunity for the parties to craft their own resolutions that are not otherwise available in litigation. The next step is to generate and weigh. You've done your analysis, you've considered your roadblocks, you now want to start generating and weighing settlement options. This is where you begin to develop your settlement range and that would meet your client's goals along with other non-monetary solutions that could resolve the dispute. Counsel should first conduct a brainstorming session to identify possible settlement options that will address your client's needs. And I think it's important here to use the skills of creativity to think outside the box and consider innovative solutions. Well, could the parties still work together? Is this a contract dispute? Is there a better way of writing this contract where both parties win? Once these potential alternatives are refined, counsel can prioritize those options and place a settlement value on each. The counsel should then collaborate with the client and the client's business people to evaluate the range of acceptable outcomes and the viability of each potential settlement option. This is where you have to have that candid discussion with your client to prevent that overly optimistic view of the client's position, to get them in the settlement frame of mind. Moving on about generating and weighing settlement options, having a candid discussion about the client with the client about the likelihood of each option is critically important here. What are the cost benefits of each option? Are there any non-monetary costs in pursuing an option? Is this the best possible outcome that will meet your client's goals and needs? Is the other side even likely to find this option acceptable, that it's even worth floating? Again, when evaluating settlement options, it's also important to consider the probability and the impact of the litigation costs and risk. And this is, I think it's important in doing a probability analysis of these various settlement options to help you determine what options are most viable and most achievable. And the one way you can do this is by engaging in this probability analysis by looking at your percentage of success on a particular claim, whether it's defensive or offensive. This is probably the most subjective part about the likely percentage of success. Then you want to assess the likely damages of the award, and then your projected attorney's fees and costs. This is where your budget comes into play. And then assess figuring all these different factors, what is your potential loss exposure for each option, and that will give you a settlement range to work. Although there are differing schools of thought about how much of this evaluation you share with the mediator, candidly disclosing such information can enable the mediator to more effectively serve your client in the other room. In any event, the most important thing about assessing these different settlement options is to actually assess them. I know that sounds silly, but the reason to assess them is the worst possible settlement option is to present at mediation as one that is pulled from thin air. The most important thing is to have a rational basis and well-reasoned justification for your settlement options, supported by calculations, documents, witness interview statements, and et cetera. Again, it's important to do this front-end assessment to allow you to go into that mediation fully prepared and ready for anything that they can throw at you. No different than a trial. I want to go to the next area that I want to focus on in the mediation preparation arena, and that is selecting the right mediator. I would say that selecting the right mediator may be the most important decision you make in a mediation, because good mediators can get cases settled and increase the likelihood of success. But you need to know what you're looking for in a mediator and whether that mediator can help the parties reach a settlement. The bottom line is the parties have to take the time to investigate and select the right mediator for a case. So what are the different types of mediators? And I think there's generally four of them. The first is the evaluative mediator. I call them the hammer. And we'll go into more detail on each of these. The second is the facilitative mediator. I refer to them as the handholder. The third type is the transformative, and to be honest, I don't have any experience in using a transformative mediator, but in reading about them, these are ones I think best are described as the marriage counselor. And then you have the hybrid. That's the shapeshifter that moves around in these different areas or different types depending upon the circumstances. So let's first talk about the hammer. These are the evaluative mediators that consider arguments and evidence presented by each side and that uses that information to evaluate the party's strengths and weaknesses. It's much like a judge in a case. I think that's why we as trial lawyers like evaluative mediators the best, because it's much more similar to the trial context. Again, because they're weighing evidence and rendering decisions in assessing the evidence in the case. A mediator's own assessment, an evaluative mediator's own assessment of the case, typically drives the mediation process. Depending on the relative strengths in the party's position, an evaluative mediator will then encourage one or both parties to move from their original positions toward a compromise. I like using evaluative mediators because they are good at giving the parties a dose of reality. And giving this dose of reality allows the parties to reach an agreement. Indeed, an evaluative mediator can persuade the parties who's more likely to win at trial and who may succeed but not succeed entirely like they thought they would. They are excellent at exposing weaknesses in cases and how that would play out in a trial setting. You can certainly, their ability to identify weaknesses if you're prepared helps you to push back. I've found that evaluative mediators are most effective in resolving business disputes, product liability claims, and matters involving the interpretation of contract. Again, the method is typically used by mediators who are former judges and largely mirrors the process they undertook in weighing evidence and rendering decisions in their careers on the bench. If this is the new normal, then and the mediation is the future, I see the evaluative mediator continuing to grow in prominence. The next type of mediator is what I refer to as the handholder. This is a facilitative mediator that encourages parties to consider the interests that form the basis for their positions and try to find a mutual agreeable position or middle ground that the parties can reach a resolution. By focusing on the underlying interest, a facilitative mediator encourages the parties to come up with possible solutions that they may not have considered. The main characteristic of the handholder or facilitative mediator is the use of shell diplomacy or caucuses. This is where the mediator shuffles back and forth between the two rooms, carrying messages, and then using that information they're provided in one room and the other room to try to get some concessions. In contrast to the evaluative style, the party's opinion drives this process more than the mediator's assessment of the case. I found that facilitative mediators are effective in employment cases and matters involving business parties that have an existing relationship that will likely continue after resolution. A good facilitative mediator will set the table to have the claimant tell their side of the story. By allowing the party with the grievance to be heard, a facilitative mediator can help the parties overcome emotional aspects of the case and focus on the overall goals. The third is the marriage counselor, the transformative mediator. This mediator focuses on the underlying relationships between the parties and focuses on how they will continue to exist and thrive together rather than focusing on the legal rights or their individual interests. They are often, and this is why I've never used them, often disregarded as an option in commercial disputes and traditional business disputes because lawyers, admittedly, myself included, often overlook the emotional components of the cases that a transformative mediator really likes to latch onto. But I have heard that these mediators can be quite good in cases where a monetary settlement is not of the highest importance, but rather an apology or the desire by the parties to work together in the future are particularly important. The last type is probably the most often used, and that's the shapeshifter. These are mediators who don't fit particularly into one box, but they use their techniques of being a facilitative mediator and then shifting to an evaluative mediator to build up trust, to get the clients talking about about their positions, and then, and only then, evaluating the positions in order to get concessions. I think these are probably some of the best mediators that are able to adapt their styles and recognize that one size fit all approach doesn't always work. So before selecting a mediator, and we've done this in the pre-mediation assessment, but one has to understand the client's needs and goals. Selecting a mediator who can best resolve a dispute that meets your client's needs and goals can increase the overall client satisfaction with the mediation process. Other factors that impact selection, and I'm on page 37 of the PowerPoint, is the party's emotions. If you have a highly emotional client, an evaluative mediator that uses a hammer approach may not be the best in keeping your client's emotions in check. However, if you have an opposing counsel that has a very aggressive style and approach, sometimes an evaluative mediator is perfect. They can give that opposing counsel or their client a dose of reality and, for lack of a better word, put them in their place. I think it's also important to figure out, in selecting the right mediator, events that have occurred before the mediation. What has happened in the underlying litigation? Does that impact the type of mediator you need? I don't think there's a bright line test there, but certainly a consideration that needs to be made. The next step is outlining a process with opposing counsel for selecting the right mediator. I think the important point here is to ask questions of opposing counsel, get on the same page with opposing counsel about how much the parties are willing to spend. Are you going to spend $5,000 on the mediation, or are you going to spend $15,000? Where do you want to hold the mediation? All the logistic things that could get in the way of selecting the right mediator. I also think it's important to talk with opposing counsel. If you want an evaluative mediator and you think that suits your client's goals, talk to the opposing counsel about why you think that an evaluative mediator will help you achieve settlement. If the parties cannot agree on a particular mediator, which I think probably happens half the time, it's important to work with opposing counsel to develop a process for exchanging names and lists. The next step then is to find a potential mediator. You want to assess the mediator's experience with the magnitude of the and complexity of the case. I'm a firm believer that the more complex the case is, the more experienced the mediator should be. I think if there's other intangible qualities you're looking for in a mediator, feel free to pick up the phone with their case manager and have a phone interview with them and talk to their references. As I mentioned earlier, I think one of the hallmarks of a great trial lawyer is tenacity, but I also believe that one of the great skills of a mediator is tenacity. Will they take the time to prepare for the mediation, and are they willing to see the matter through to conclusion? If you take only one thing away from this portion of the presentation, find a mediator, doesn't matter what type they are, find a mediator with some tenacity. One word of caution, I've fallen into this trap before, so I'm fully aware of this pitfall, unfortunately, but a mediator's fee is not necessarily a good indication of his or her experience, effectiveness, and competence. One of the best mediators I ever had was a former federal court magistrate judge who wanted to stay active in the bar and did the mediation for free because it allowed her to continue to be involved. But she was fully retired, only did it in the summertime, spent the rest of the time in Florida. So, and she was free, and one of the most effective mediators I've ever had. One of the big questions is, does your mediator need to be a subject matter expert? This is one I debate to myself over and over, and I don't have the right answer. I can give you some thoughts on it, and that is, I think generally having some expertise is an asset for a mediator because it does save time and money and increase the predictability of the mediation process, but it also can be a liability if that mediator uses that technical expertise to impose their own view and ignores the facts and evidence presented by the parties. You want the mediator to be working for you. Now, they'll never admit they're working for you, but you at least want them working for the deal. A mediator that knows the territory enables them to focus on the issues that really matter, which does create some efficiencies. When deciding to select a mediator with technical expertise, I think the one takeaway you can have on this is you have to determine whether that particular technical issue or expertise is important to resolving the dispute. If it is, then, you know, perhaps using a mediator with some expertise is important. The next step you need to do is conduct due diligence. I think the main thing you need to take away from here is you always will get mediator references. They're always going to put the people that are happy. So when I talk with a case manager, I want references from the last five mediations. And I want to ask those people one important question. Did the case settle? And that, to me, is the most important thing because it goes towards their experience and their ability to see the matter through. It goes to whether they are tenacious. Now, it may not settle at the mediation, but did it settle shortly thereafter is probably a better way of phrasing that question. The last step, then, is to pick your mediator. And I think the important point here is the goal is not to win your preferred mediator, but to reach an agreement with the parties. If your mediator that you think is perfect for this case that will get the resolution is rejected, question opposing counsel on why they rejected this mediator. Force them to articulate the reasons other than it was proposed by you. I've found that accepting the other side's mediator can be very beneficial. It develops a level of trust on the front end. It shows a step in the right direction that you're willing to compromise, and I think can help get the mediation off to a good start. So let's move now. After you've done your pre-mediation assessment, selected the mediator, I think one of the important things is to engage in a pre-mediation structure. And this basically is to spend the time. What the purpose of this analysis and developing a settlement structure is to get the small things out of the way and focus on the big issues at the mediation. Iron out the smaller issues that could trip up a mediation but aren't essential to reaching a settlement, or at least if they are, you know that on the front end, and that becomes an important component to your actual mediation. The important thing to remember here is that it doesn't mean if you agree on a settlement structure on the front end, it doesn't necessarily mean that you'll reach a resolution, but it does provide a roadmap and allows you to iron out the differences on the front end before you walk into a mediation. By addressing this and potential settlement terms prior to the mediation, the parties can ensure that they are focused on the main issues and they're spending the time and investment in focusing on the real issues that matter to settlement of the case. The first step in a settlement structure is to develop potential structures. And that is, you know, what are different settlement scenarios? If it's a buy-sell, what does the settlement look like if you buy versus your partner who buys? How does the settlement structure change? I think it's important to do this on the front end because a mediator going into the process is not going to have all the nuances of what these parties need to reach a settlement. Again, you want to assess the different scenarios that could come up in a case. Is this your typical party A pays party B? Well, at least document that and then talk about other issues that are important to structuring that settlement. You certainly don't want to reach a monetary settlement at the mediation and then fight over satellite issues. So what are these basic terms? What do I mean when I say develop a settlement structure? And these are the basic questions. What claims are being released if we agree on a settlement? What parties will be released? How broad are the releases? Do you need a confidentiality or non-disparagement clause? How are the attorney's fees going to be allocated? How are you going to pay? Is it going to be by wire? Is it by check? Do you need a W-9? All these are important issues to assess on the front end, because you don't want to end up in that worst-case scenario where you agree on a settlement, but these satellite issues such as confidentiality derails the process. The next thing you want to do is actually create term sheets, and this is where you would want to memorialize these settlement structures in writing. Proposed term sheet should address those issues that we just discussed, but it should be flexible enough to change on the fly as the mediation proceeds. It doesn't have to be anything extensive. It can be several bullet points and include the provisions that for each settlement scenario that the party believes are vital to the settlement. The fourth step in this pre-mediation settlement structure is simply to exchange them with the other side. And also discuss whether to share these with the mediator. It can be helpful, and I've done it before, is sharing these settlement structures with the mediator so they know what issues are most critical to reaching a resolution. The fifth is then to evaluate the term sheets. Is there additional exchanges that will help clarify the scenarios that are presented? Is there a solution presented by the other side that's a roadblock, it's just not workable? Again, this process allows parties to evaluate the risk and rewards and explore several settlement paths prior to the mediation. Back to the roadmap I want to talk now, and I'm on page 50, is using experts at mediation. And I'll be brief because we've talked about this before, but I think experts can add a significant value to the mediation process. If mediation is a new normal, why not use experts? They can help identify missing information and offer creative solutions. They can also simplify issues by isolating facts and eliminating satellite issues relating to damages or technical issues. They can assist by preparing demonstratives and other important information that you can use to persuade the other side and the mediator. Experts can also help you maintain focus. They help moderate the tone of the mediation by presenting data with an air of objectivity, and they can take your client out of the spotlight, and you can put the expert in the spotlight, particularly on numbers or technical issues. I think having an expert either there or available by phone brings credibility with the mediator and the other side's decision maker by showing that a good faith difference of opinion exists, and your expert personifies that. You've heard me say a realistic bargaining zone, but I think experts can also be used in having your discussions with your clients to prevent unrealistic expectations. The experts can use their damage calculations to set brackets for ranges. They can also evaluate proposals that have been submitted during the course of shuttle diplomacy and figure out what numbers make sense. Experts have also seen a lot of different things and typically are well informed on tax policies and other financial instruments that they can help you craft creative solutions and alternative approaches from a financial perspective and help you troubleshoot those potential solutions. One word of caution I think it's important to say here about using experts in a mediation, which I think can, again, be a big bonus for you in the mediation process, but there is a possibility of waiver of confidentiality. There's a chance the expert's work product could be discoverable if the matter does not settle. You do have the protections of mediation statutes. I recognize that, but some of the best practices to keep that from happening is to isolate your experts, make sure that they are using their materials and are labeling those materials for settlement purposes only, and then you can stipulate to the other side. You can be frank with them to say, hey, I'm bringing a mediation, or I'm bringing an expert to the mediation. if let's agree that that won't be discoverable. Before I move on to the next topic, I want to raise the New York regulations and the code number. In order to comply with New York regulations, attorneys looking for CLE credit in New York will need to be able to provide a code. I will read this code twice and only twice and cannot repeat it or email it to you. So please make note of it. The New York state code number is TR2947-52119. Again, the New York state code is TR2947-52119. Let's go to our final area to look at, and that is the opening statement at mediation. This is a controversial area, ranging from that opening statements are a complete waste of time and counterproductive or essential to the process. Again, if this is the new normal, presenting an opening statement can add value and make settlement more likely. So the first thing I want to talk about is considerations in giving an opening statement. Should you give one? I think there's really it's not always appropriate in every case, and they can backfire. I've learned from experience that I've seen them backfire. And while there's no bright line test, these factors should be used in determining whether to give an opening statement. The first is, do you need to educate the mediator? Second is, do you need to educate the opposing party? Do you need to personalize your client to the other side? Do we need to recognize the party's feelings? Do we need to set the right tone to create a atmosphere for settlement? And then what are the timing aspects? Where are we at with the underlying case? I think giving an opening statement is the most efficient way to educate the mediator about your case. The most effective way to educate the mediator of your case rather than exchanging documents. Or dribbling out this information through a series of caucus sessions. The opening statement allows the mediator to cut to the chase, and it brings to life the issues that may not have been clear during the pre-mediation conferences or any written submissions. However, well-prepared briefs and mediation statements may be sufficient. Again, don't give an opening statement if it's just going to be a regurgitation of what you put in your mediation briefs. I think most importantly is an opportunity to educate the opposing party who your opposing lawyer may be failing to communicate both the pros and the cons. This is your chance to talk directly to the decision maker in the case in the non-adversarial context of a mediation. However, this can fail if the goal is to persuade the opposition of the correctness of your position rather than educate. This goes to that point I made very early on that trial lawyers need to learn to tweak their trial skills and may not want to use the hammer, but instead use a little bit of a softer touch in that opening statement, in less chest beating, and the goal would be to teach rather than to persuade. It's also time to personalize your client, and I think the best way to personalize your client is considering having that client participate in the opening statement. I have found it very effective to have my client make a few remarks or present a position in the opening statement of a mediation. It personalizes them. It shows them that shows the other side that real people have made these decisions, they've considered these issues, and they're willing to talk and be rational about reaching a resolution at the mediation. Actually, having them present an opening statement is probably the most effective way to do this. The two sides don't get along, that may only antagonize them, but in some case, antagonize both sides and get us off on the wrong foot. But it can be useful if under the right circumstances. You also want to recognize the other party's feelings. I think this is, if the party's emotions are running high and there's personality conflicts, it's best just to skip the opening statement. Or if you're far along in the litigation and the litigation's been hostile, there's no really benefit to gain from having an opening statement. However, if the party's feelings are lukewarm, you can help. The mediation opening statement can be used to diffuse some of these negative emotions and allow you to start the mediation on a positive note, which kind of leads to the next consideration, and that is setting the right tone. I think it's important in any opening statement to make it clear that you're not there to fight, but to resolve the case. And the best way to do this is to make conciliatory statements. I know that's hard for advocates and trial lawyers, but in the mediation context, I think it's important to say, hey, look, there are some things you're right about. There's some things that we're right about. I hope you'll listen. Again, using hostile opening statements or chest beating or table pounding is not these courtroom theatrics, which I don't think are very effective in the trial courtroom, they're going to be equally bad, if not worse, in the mediation context. Another important consideration on whether to give opening statements is the timing aspects. I think if there's a bright line rule here is the earlier in the case or even prior to a case is filed, a mediation statement is important. But I think as the case, because the point of these opening statements is to educate the decision maker. But as you move farther along in the case, briefs have been filed, depositions have been taken, there's not a lot of education to happen at that point. So I'm not sure there's a lot of value in educating when the facts have been fleshed out and there's just differences of opinion. So let's end with best practices in giving these opening statements. And we've talked a little bit about it in going over the various considerations, but I think one of the best practices is that you cannot take an adversarial approach. We've talked about not pounding on tables. You have to strike the right balance between promoting your client's position, proceeding in a conciliatory manner, educating the other side with the consistent goal of reaching a settlement. It goes back to the original point about trial lawyers needing to tweak their skills just slightly. Use all those great characteristics and skill sets that we have, tweak them ever so slightly, and you can be a powerful mediation advocate. So what is the first thing you need to know about giving a mediation opening statement? The first is know your audience. You're not trying to persuade the mediator. You're trying to persuade the decision maker sitting across the table from you. Know your audience and craft your message just like you would when you go to persuade the judge or jury. Know your audience. Try to convince the opposing party that your client has the better case and the risk of continued litigation necessitates settlement. I think it's important to be very factual and evidence-based in educating the decision maker. You want too many lawyers decline the opportunity to explain key evidence during the opening statements in a mediation. Instead, focus their time on rebutting various positions by the other side. But this is your one and perhaps only chance to educate the opposing party who may be hearing a lot of this evidence for the first time. One word of caution on opening statements and persuading the decision maker, be aware that your opening to educate the opposing party can fail if its sole purpose is to persuade rather than educate. Done right, an opening statement that educates both sides on the issue and starts the negotiations based upon a common understanding gets you out on the right foot. And all roads lead to preparation. We've talked about how to prepare for mediation, and let's talk about why it's important to prepare for your opening statement. You can't wing an effective mediation opening statement. You got to prepare just like you would prepare for trial. Why? Because this communicates to the other side the readiness to the opposing party, the decision maker, that you have done your homework. You're in command of the facts and the law, and you can explain how this case will unfold if the parties do not reach a settlement. I think it's important here to explicitly state that you and your client have spent time preparing for this mediation, significant time. This allows you to impress on the other side that you are a skilled and talented trial attorney who will make even more compelling arguments for your client if you get into the courtroom. Coming to the mediation carefully with a carefully crafted opening statement allows you to increase your chances of having a successful resolution and getting this process out on the right foot. Again, word of caution on giving your opening statements. I found it very boring and ineffective when I see lawyers in opening statements rely on a PowerPoint presentation, rely on tons of case law citation, and have a super long opening statement. This shows that you're not prepared, and by using citations and case law, you're persuading the wrong people. You're not there to persuade the mediator. You're not there to persuade the opposing party. You're there to persuade the decision maker who probably isn't trained in the law and doesn't know the first thing about case citations. Continuing on, another important thing in giving a opening statement is that your tone has to be critical. You have to have a conversation. You're not making an argument, trial argument, that you would deliver to a jury or in a courtroom. You cannot set an adversarial tone. Instead, you need to set a positive tone and that you avoid statements that will elicit a strong negative reaction. It's important to not create resentment and to get people, encourage the opposing party to lower its guard and provoking an aggressive response. A good trial lawyer has the skills necessary to make an effective presentation without creating resentment and the ability to foster an atmosphere of trust and a willingness to compromise. Tweak those skills, give a good opening where tone is critical. The last thing is I think you should be explicit about your purpose. Stress that you and your client are at the mediation not to be adversarial, but to resolve the dispute. You've come here prepared. Let's address any issues and move on and avoid the cost and uncertainty of litigation. Before I go to the takeaways, I want to read the New York code number one more time, and that is, in order to comply with New York regulations, attorneys looking for CLE credit in New York will need to be able to provide a code. I will read this code twice and only twice and cannot repeat it or email it to you. So please make note of it. The New York State code number is TR2947-52119. Again, the New York State code number is TR2947-52119. So what are the takeaways from our time together today? I think it's important to if you're a trial lawyer, to refine your trial skills to be an effective mediation advocate. Again, if you're in-house counsel, find those trial lawyers that have done that and can be a worthy advocate for you in the mediation conference room and get you a settlement. Like trial, mediation preparation is the key to success. Coming to the mediation fully prepared by engaging in a pre-mediation assessment, taking the time to select the right mediator, having an expert that can help you with the mediation, and having prepared an effective opening statement can all help you reach a resolution of your dispute and make you an effective advocate in the new normal of mediation. If there are any questions, please let me know. I'm looking on the website. I don't see any questions, but feel free to reach out to me if you have any questions. I appreciate your time, and I hope you have enjoyed the presentation. Thank you. Bye.